Straight Talk from Israel.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for listening. Like every week here in Israel, there are a lot of interesting news items because Israel is not a boring place. There is an ancient Chinese blessing where you tell someone, I hope you live in quiet times. That's a blessing. For better or worse, that blessing simply never worked out for the Jews. We never live in quiet times because we face the world not only as Jews today, but also as the Jewish nation, the State of Israel. And a lot of classic anti-Semitism has now taken on the guise of anti-Israelism. At any rate, among all the news items of interest this week, I think the two most important are, one is the way that our prime minister was welcomed in India. The prime minister of Israel, one of the smallest states in the world, was given a royal welcome to India, one of the largest nations in the world. And it wasn't just a polite diplomatic visit. Netanyahu's delegation had 130 Israeli business persons, and they got involved in all kinds of civilian economic engagements, which range from agriculture, diamonds, and water treatment to encouraging entrepreneurship among India's youth by connecting them with Israeli startups. A free trade agreement, which is being negotiated, could triple non-defense commerce from less than $5 billion today per year to $15 billion. And the second important item this week is the cat is finally out of the bag. Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, finally pulled off the mask and defined what the Palestinian Authority is, something many of us have known since it was founded back at the time of the Oslo Agreement. It is a terrorist entity dedicated to the destruction of the State of Israel and the murder of Jews. The people who brought the Palestinian Authority into existence won the Nobel Peace Prize for doing so, but all they did was bring death and misery to thousands of people, including both Jews and Arabs. So I'll say a few words about these topics because I think they're the prime topics this week. In particular, and they show two things. One shows that Israel is expanding to the Far East and also to African area because we're losing support in the European Union, and also the fact that the Palestinian Authority is now shown to be what it really was from the very beginning. I think that's quite important. So stay tuned, and thanks for listening. I'll be back with more detail.
Always challenging the status quo. Hello, I'm Rod Bryant on Beyond the Matrix here at IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. I want to encourage you to listen each week, every Wednesday at the same time, for an amazing show that will challenge you, inform you, and inspire news, views, and wisdom for the nations. Here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com. Don't forget, Beyond the Matrix every week, Wednesday, here on IsraelNewsTalkRadio.com.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. This week, the news is replete with all kinds of responses to the use of foul language by the American president. This has pushed a lot of more important news off the headlines. And as far as Israel is concerned, that is a pity. We have to evaluate the President of the United States by his policies toward American leadership in the world, the threats posed by countries like Iran and North Korea, and in particular his attitude toward Israel in the Middle East. Many years ago when I was campaigning to promote the National Religious Party among English speakers here in Israel, I had occasion to speak at a luncheon. And one of the persons in the audience said that he was not going to vote for the National Religious Party because he did not like the leader of the party, a gentleman named Zevulun Hammer, who has since passed away. A great man, I think. At any rate, I said to this fellow, in that case, you can vote for the party, but simply do not invite Hammer to your house for dinner. You don't have to like the behavior or the language of a party leader or a politician or a statesman or a diplomat. You have to like his policies. That is what counts. And having said that, consider the following. U.S. President Donald Trump's policy announcement recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital was and is a milestone in the history of Israel and in the history of the Jewish people. It is evident that the city has not only been recognized as a capital, but its deep link to the Jewish people has also been acknowledged. The U.S. veto in the United Nations shortly after that was not only a resounding reconfirmation of the policy, but evidence of the strong antipathy toward not only Israel, but also toward the United States at the United Nations. As the U.S. United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley reiterated, no other country would tolerate a dictate concerning where it puts its embassies. We are thus on the threshold of a new era in the U.S. Middle East policy. I think so. A draft of President Donald Trump's new national security strategy became available, and there are significant departures from that issued by its predecessor, Barack Obama. In this new document, there is a statement as follows. For generations, the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians has been understood as the prime irritant preventing peace and prosperity in the region. Today, the threats from radical jihadist terrorist organizations and a threat from Iran are creating the realization that Israel is not the cause of the region's problems. States have increasingly found common interests with Israel in confronting common threats. That's what it says in this about-to-be-released statement. This contrasts pretty much with the received wisdom regards Israel and the Palestinians that for previous years. For example, in September 2013, the Secretary of State, John Kerry, speaking of the position and the U.S. and the Arab League, said, "We are all of us agreed that an Israeli-Palestinian final status agreement is important in enhancing regional security and stability throughout the Middle East." Now, in recent events, and indeed the entire decade-long period of the Arab war in Israel has made one thing clear. It is that the lack of a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinian Arabs is manifestly not the basis or the core of the Middle East's violence and bloodshed. Just for example, look what's happening in the Middle East today. Syria, Iraq, Yemen are conflicts and flashpoints. And these are all totally irrelevant to Israel and the Palestinians. If Israel didn't exist, the same problems between and within the Arab countries would be proceeding unhindered. It would be the same thing. Consider the following, a little bit of history. In the 1950s, the Arab War in Israel had no bearing whatsoever on the Algerian decolonization war, the Yemen-Aden clashes, the first post-war outbreak of violence in Lebanon. That was in the 50s. In the 1960s, Israel and the Palestinians had no bearing on the Egyptian invasion of North Yemen, the Omani Civil War, the bloody emergence of the Ba'athist dictatorship in Iraq or in Aden. And these things collectively claimed thousands of lives. And that's the 60s. In the 70s, Israel-Palestinian problem had nothing whatsoever to do with the bloody conflict between Morocco and the Polisario in Western Sahara, or the Libyan-Chad War, the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, or the outbreak of Turkish-Kurdish fighting, which claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. That was the 70s. Now, in the 1980s, the Palestinian-Israel conflict had nothing to do with the South Yemen civil war, Saddam Hussein's chemical weapons attack on the Iraqi Kurds, which claimed thousands of lives, or the eight-year Iran-Iraqi war, which claimed over a million lives, and particularly children who were sent to fight. That was in the 80s. Look at the 90s now. The Palestinian-Israeli problem had nothing to do with Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, Saddam Hussein's subsequent campaign of massacre against the Kurds in the north of his country and the Marsh Arabs in the south, which collectively claimed hundreds of thousands of lives. So if the Arab War in Israel is a distinct conflict generally unrelated to other regional flashpoints, it should be obvious that for the United States to declare it to be the head of all the region's woes is absurd and is also damaging to American interests for several reasons, including the fact that an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement, were ever attainable, would not solve the other regional problems, which are rooted in the region's ideological and religious pathologies. You can't change them. These struggles of hundreds of years old. Asserting the centrality of Israelis and Palestinians to regional turbulence benefits no one but the Arab despots, who avail themselves of the U.S. preoccupation with this issue to continue to unhindered in incubating radical Islamic movements and repressing their own people. This in turn leads successive administrations into pursuing all kind of diplomatic initiatives between the Palestinians and the Israelis, which are doomed to failure. And then the failure is attributed to America and to Israel. So making a fetish of an alleged Israeli-Palestinian peace process squanders American resources, it squanders American capability and credibility and America's standing. So, and apparently President Trump's officials are still at work framing the contours of what he likes to call the ultimate deal. I don't think there is anything as the ultimate deal in the Middle East. However, if the new strategy is any guide from these few things that have leaked, it will be wisely prioritizing dealing with the genuinely regional threats than confront America and its allies, and not the Palestinian-Israeli problem, which is not only secondary, it's like you might even list it as tertiary. It doesn't appear at all on the horizon. By the way, since we're talking about the Palestinians and the Palestinian thought, I want to mention that it's important to note that the terrorists are rewarded by the Palestinian Authority for spilling the blood of innocent Israelis, and this has been released by New Statistics. 2 weeks ago, the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, there was a disclosure by our defense ministry that the Palestinian Authority paid out well over $500 million to Palestinian terrorists and their families over the past 2 years, only the 2 years. In 2016, the Palestinian Authority shelled out $320 million to terrorists and their families. That was in 2016. In 2017, the figure rose to $347 million. And even more astonishing is that the Palestinian Authority relies on foreign aid from Europe and the United States, as well on taxes and customs revenues that are transferred to it by Israel. So the Palestinian Authority takes this money and doles out enormous sums to terrorists and their families, therefore, and thereby signaling the priority it places on providing financial incentives for Palestinians to be terrorists. So a would-be government like the Palestinian Authority goes people to violence, provides terrorists with shelter and immunity, and then bestows financial gifts to them cannot and must not be considered a legitimate governing body or a possible partner for peace. Washington should cut off aid to the Palestinians, and that is what President Trump threatened to do earlier this month. There's no reason for the American taxpayers to send money to Palestinian Authority at the same time it's funneling its funds for terrorists. There's been plenty of talk over the years about such steps, but now is the time for the United States and Israel to translate that talk into action, because essentially what it says is that the United States, by funding the Palestinian Authority, is funding terrorism. That's what it amounts to. And Israel, by letting the Palestinians get their tax money for things imported into their area, by allowing to get that money is funding terrorism. That's what it amounts to. As crazy it may seem, when you really think about it, that is what's actually happening. So the fact that the Trump administration may be taking or appears to be taking a new step is a healthy sign. Question, of course, is what will that state, the new conditions be, and will it reflect the reality of the Middle East? I hope it does. I'll be back after the break.
Hello, I am Walter Bingham. If you want to hear the news behind the news and the true perspective on world affairs, then the Walter Bingham File is the program for you. We bring you interviews with the movers and shakers, political commentaries, and on-the-spot reports of events as they happen. All here every Tuesday, 4 p.m. Israel time, 9 a.m. Eastern time. And it's all archived on our website. Make it a date.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
Hi, you're back with Jay Shapiro. Before I get to the subject that I originally planned to speak about on this segment, I want to share with the listeners some thoughts about our Prime Minister's present visit to India. Our Prime Minister is now in India. He took a delegation with 130 Israeli business persons, and the whole purpose was to broaden the civilian economic engagements with India, which range from agriculture, diamonds, and water treatment to encouraging business among India's youth by connecting with Israeli startups. A free trade agreement, which is being negotiated, could triple non-defense commerce between the two countries from less than $5 billion to $15 billion. The signing of 9 separate agreements meant to enhance cooperation in a variety of fields. They signed these agreements while they are there. They covered everything from a memorandum of understanding on cybersecurity, which aims to promote cooperation through training programs, and also skill development in simulation-based hands-on training. They had another memorandum of understanding on exploring opportunities for bilateral engagements in the oil and gas field. Now, our relationship with India, which has had ups and downs, is now apparently at a peak, thank heaven. But what the thought that I wanted to share with the listeners had to do with a little article, a small article, a side article concerning the trip. Our Prime Minister was greeted very warmly in India with honor guards. And they had the grandeur of the setting when he was greeted there. New Delhi's palatial, brown-bricked, 350-room presidential residence. And there were horses there ridden by cavalry in black turbans, red coats, white gloves, silver swords. And there was 100-strong military honor guard there to greet our prime minister. There was a stirring rendition of the Israeli and Indian national anthems. But what moved our prime minister, he said afterward, and this is the point I wanted to share with the listeners, was putting the whole scene in historical perspective. The respect that a nation of some 1.3 billion people, India, a good proportion of all humanity, that nation gave respect to the leader of Israel, a country of less than 9 million people, a small proportion of even only the Middle East. Our prime minister said, "I marched on the red carpet in front of the Indian honor guard at the place of government of this tremendous power. I thought that I represent a nation that was crushed to pieces and destroyed 75 years ago And today I was received here at Prime Minister with the honor and glory befitting a nation among nations, and even more than that. Our Prime Minister said it moved him. When you look at it in historical perspective, it's an expression of the return of the Jewish people to the world stage. And his thought, which I just read, I want to share with the listeners. The 75 years ago, we were in the midst of the Holocaust. 6 million Jews were killed, and nobody really gave a damn. All the countries, including the democratic Western countries, locked their doors so the Jews had no place to escape to. And Great Britain, influenced by the Arabs, locked the doors of Palestine, the land that, according to the League of Nations Charter and the UN, was supposed to be given to the Jews as their natural homeland. And we've gone from that to being a high-tech power. More people are studying Talmud and Torah in Eretz Israel and the land of Israel today than any time since the destruction of the temple. And when our prime minister goes to a country with over 1 billion people, one of the biggest countries in the world, and one of the biggest powers in the world, our prime minister goes there and gets the respect that he was given, representing our little nation. I think those of us who have lived through this, or those of us who are alive today, can appreciate the great historical change that has occurred, for which we have to be appreciative and to thank God. The visit to India, I really think, stands out as like a high point in Jewish history, particularly in the last 100 years. Now, what I'm going to speak about now has to do with our relationship with the Palestinian Authority, or its other name, the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. And I have to introduce this subject by mentioning a book that was written back in 1984 by Barbara Tuchman, an American historian. She wrote a book called The March of Folly, From Troy to Vietnam. The book is about one of the most compelling paradoxes of history: their pursuit by governments of policies contrary to their own interests. And in the book, she details 4 major instances of government folly that we know in human history. One is the Trojan decision to move the Greek horse into their city. The second is the failure of the Renaissance popes to address the factors that would lead to the Protestant Reformation. The third is England's policies related to American colonies under King George III, and the United States' mishandling of the conflict in Vietnam. Now, Barbara Tuchman applies the concept of folly to historical mistakes with certain features in common, and this is the important point, the certain features in common. That is, the policy taken was contrary to self-interest. It was not that of an individual attributable to the individual's character, but it's attributable to the action of a group. It was not the only policy available, and it was pursued despite forebodings that it was mistaken. The only way to account for such self-destructive policies, in Tuchman's view, is to label them as follies. Now, what I've said up to now is introduction. Now, she wrote the book in 1984, which is essentially almost 10 years to the day before the signing of the Oslo Agreement. Had she written a book 12 years later, she could have included the signing of the Oslo Agreement. It was done by the government of Israel with the support of the Western democracies. It was taken by a group. It was contrary to the self-interest of our nation, and it was pursued despite forebodings that it was taken. It was mistaken. The only way, as I say, to account for such self-destructive policies is to label them as follies. So had Barbara Tuchman written the book a dozen years later, she could have included the Oslo Agreement under the general heading that she defines as a folly. And before I discuss what's happening now, it's interesting to note that at the time when the Oslo Agreement was signed, to the best of my knowledge, there are only two commentators or observers who said that it was a mistake. One was George Will, a columnist and a opinion writer in the United States, and the other was Charles Krauthammer, who said that this was a terrible mistake and that it would lead to bloodshed. They were the only two commentators and observers who called the Oslo Agreement what it actually was. It was a classic and historical folly in the history of the Jewish people. It was one of the biggest mistakes we ever made, and now we're suffering from it. Incidentally, at the time I wrote about it, and I was attacked by several people. I had a radio program at that time, and I also had a column I was writing, and I took issue with a lot of the people who were famous people, including famous Jewish leaders, who thought that the Oslo Agreement would bring peace in the Middle East and bring peace to Israel. Now, what I'd like to address now is the result that we are now living with. Actually, I want to make one other point before I talk about the result, and that is that Yasser Arafat, Shimon Peres, and Yitzhak Rabin won the Nobel Peace Prize for the Oslo Agreement. And just to give you an idea how confused the world was, Shimon Peres wrote a book shortly afterwards called The New Middle East. And he said the following, I'm reading from the cover of his book: "A rare opportunity to create a new golden age in the Middle East has arisen after the Gulf War. We are all in need of it, and any other alternative would be a collective punishment for all peoples in our region. We can begin today by taking the first steps across the bridge of mutual cooperation and understanding among Middle East peoples. The journey ahead will be long, but the way is open, and we need brave travelers." This is what Shimon Peres wrote when he received the reward. And in the New Middle East, a book which I bought at a used bookstore for $1.19, I'm saving it because I think it's going to become an all-time classic, he has a compelling vision of the future for the Middle East, which has absolutely nothing to do with reality, but got him and Arafat and Rabin a Nobel Prize. I'll talk more about that after the break.
Israel News Talk Radio, straight talk from Israel.
Shalom from the heartland of Israel. This is David Ha'ivri. Join me every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time, 10 o'clock Eastern, for A Hebrew in the Heartland on Israel News Talk Radio. Hear the news and views from the heartland of Israel every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Israel time. Be there.
You're listening to The Jay Shapiro Show.
In this final segment of the program, I want to talk about two topics. First, I want to say something about the head of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, who's in the 11th year of his four-year term, and he finally let the cat out of the bag. In a long speech last week, in Ramallah to the Palestine Liberation Organization's Central Council, he blasted Israel, he blasted U.S. President Donald Trump, and he also blasted some Arab states. He decided to convene the Central Council, which is a high decision-making body, in response to Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and initiate the relocation of a U.S. embassy in Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He made a number of comments about Zionism and the Jewish history that were, I think you could best describe them as controversial. He said Israel is a colonial project with no relationship to Judaism. He expressed his frustration with Trump. He said he would not accept the U.S. president's forthcoming peace plan, and he used extremely harsh and direct language toward Trump. He referred to the American president, said if they did not return to the American president said if they don't return to the negotiating table, he'd be very upset, in which response Abbas said, "May God destroy your house." And he used an Arabic saying equivalent to saying "damn you" in English. He confirmed in his speech the suspicions that his goal was not territorial compromise, but renouncing the right of the Jewish people to a state in the land of Israel. His speech was laced with anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, and his incitement against Israel and the United States should be condemned by anyone interested in peaceful coexistence. As a matter of fact, Deputy Minister Michael Oren asked the new European Union ambassador to Israel to have the EU publicly condemn the anti-Semitic and anti-European overtones in Abbas's speech. He said that Abbas repeated the anti-Semitic lie that the Europeans slaughtered the Jews and sent their survivors to the Middle East to serve European interests. The EU never misses an opportunity to condemn Israel. The time has come for the EU to demonstrate balance and criticize Abbas's disgraceful lies. Anyhow, to sum up, the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has disqualified himself as a serious peace partner, if he ever was one. Israel has complained for years about Palestinian incitement, and Abbas's speech revealed that the source for the incitement is Abbas himself. That's the bottom line. We knew that to begin with, but now it's out on the table. I spoke previously about the really warm welcome that our Prime Minister got in India and the large number of cooperative projects taking place between India and Israel. Although he has a large number of problems here in Israel, our Prime Minister, including personal problems and accusations of dishonesty and corruption and cronyism, there's no doubt our Prime Minister's foreign policy is successful. He's opened up Israel to business and diplomatic relations, particularly with the Far East and with Africa, which is particularly important because our relationship with the European Union is going from bad to worse. I want to take a look at the what's happening vis-a-vis Israel and the Jews in Western European countries and the European Union. A central problem remains that the widespread demonization of Israel. Polls taken in 9 countries confirmed that high percentages of the populations in Europe agree with such statements such as, "What the state of Israel does today to the Palestinians is in principle no different from what the Nazis did to the Jews under Hitler." And Israel conducts a war of extermination against the Palestinians. Statistics show that in East European countries, at least 38% of the population agrees with such statements. The figure is highest, by the way, in Poland, which is 63%. These are all indicative of extreme anti-Israel bias in a number of countries in Europe. Concerning Germany, 7 polls exist on these attitudes taken between 2004 and 2015. The latest poll taken in 2015 found that 41% of Germans see Israel as behaving like Nazis. Anti-Semitism in several European countries seems to be expanding. Many in the European establishment have made efforts to suppress information or avoid mentioning the important role of Muslims in aggression and hate mongering against Jews and against Israel. This has delayed major aspect of anti-Semitism from coming forcefully into the European domain because they simply don't talk about it. A variety of detailed studies show that anti-Semitism among Muslim immigrants to Europe and their descendants by far exceeds that of the original populations of Europe. It's interesting to note, by the way, that all Jews killed in Western Europe so far in this century were murdered by Muslims. A UK study, a United Kingdom study published in September last year, found that almost 13% of Muslims there have strong anti-Semitic attitudes, whereas only less than 4% of the general population hold such opinions. So the Muslim dislike of the Jews is four times as big as the native population. The same study, by the way, found that about 35% of Muslims in the UK have strong Israel attitudes, whereas only 9% of the general population do. So research among recent refugees from Syria and Iraq and Germany indicates far stronger anti-Semitic and anti-Israel feelings than in the local populations. This additional influx of Muslims into Europe means importing more anti-Semites, a lot more anti-Semites. The overall situation in Germany has greatly deteriorated over the past several years due to the German Chancellor Merkel's irresponsible welcome policy for refugees, simply an open-door policy. The major, in September of last year, the two major parties declined, whereas the radicals rose. There's been an explosion of anti-Semitic expression in the Labour Party in the United Kingdom. It's entirely possible the United Kingdom Conservative government will fall this year due to problems concerning the Brexit negotiations. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn, who is an anti-Semite, he calls Hezbollah and Hamas his friends. He might win the next election. The situation for Jews in France could be called stable. Two candidates in the 2017 presidential election, one the extreme right and the other extreme left, together received 40% of the vote. Both the extreme right, Marine Le Pen, and the extreme left, Jean-Luc Mélenchon, or Mélenchon, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, denied that France is responsible for the extreme anti-Semitic crimes perpetrated by the wartime Vichy government. This is a great step backward in France. Extreme right parties have in the new century become more significant in a variety of European countries because they're being strengthened by Muslim terrorism. Those of these parties who wish to participate in government usually moderate their official positions somewhat. So you have a right-wing government in Austria and right-wing parties rising in the other countries. Sweden, by the way, remains a particular problem for both Jews and Israel. One of the worst anti-Semitic incidents to occur in Europe last year was the bombing of a synagogue in the country's second-largest city, Gothenburg, while a youth activity was taking place within the synagogue. Other bombings have occurred in Malmo, the country's third-largest city, and widely considered the capital of European anti-Semitism. Most perpetrators are Muslims or right-wing activists. After the Gutenberg attack, Swedish Prime Minister was forced by the circumstances to condemn anti-Semitism. He even indicated that immigrants play a large role in it, meaning, of course, the Muslims. The situation in the Netherlands, as far as Israel and anti-Semitism are concerned, is usually less severe than the other countries. Yet last year, it became even clearer than in the past that the police and the judiciary are partially dysfunctional in dealing with anti-Semitic incidents, which leaves, of course, neutral Switzerland a particular problem confronts the Jewish community there. The authorities have found that Jewish institutions are targets for terror, but they refuse to pay for the security of synagogues and Jewish institutions. As the authorities do supply such security for various potential non-Jewish targets, this reflects a discriminatory policy. So that's pretty much the situation in Europe, which, as I said, is going from bad to worse. And the Holocaust has been forgotten there, and there's been a tremendous rise of anti-Semitism, a tremendous rise of the white right wing, because of the Muslim influx into Europe. But the right wing seems to be basically anti-Semitic also. So you have Muslims on one side, you have anti-Semitic rightists on the other. So the fact that our government, and as I said at the beginning, the fact that our government is now turned toward strengthening relationships with the Far East and strengthening relations with Sub-Saharan Africa speaks well of our government's policy, because we're losing our relationship with Europe because of the influx of the Muslims and the rise of old-time anti-Semitism. So the European Union is not a friendly place anymore for Jews or for Israel. And the situation will probably get worse in the immediate future. It's sad to have to report this kind of thing. If you look at the statistics, you have to face reality. Having said all that, take care of yourselves until next week, and let's hope we have better news both for Israel and for the Jewish people in general. Jay Shapiro signing off.
This is Rita from League City, Texas, now living in Israel. And though my heart may have belonged to Texas, it now belongs to Israel and all the fantastic show hosts at Israel News Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Michael Solomon from Kiryat Arba, Israel. And why do I love listening to Israel News Talk Radio? Because I love listening to the interesting interviews they do and their news reporting that most other media sources don't cover.
Hey, this is Nicole Eko from Malmo, Sweden. It gets pretty cold here in Sweden, so I love cuddling up with a warm cup of tea while I listen to Israel News Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody, this is Frank Karras from Tennessee. Me and my dog Buster really love listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.
News, opinion, and more. You're listening to Israel News Talk Radio.